Okay, so what are we going to be doing for the next little while? And why are we bothering? Because that should be the question that comes through anybody's mind who's going to be sitting listening to somebody talk at them. Over the course of the many years that I've been here in the paradoxes class, and the times when I've taught, the times when I've asked questions, people have said, well, you know, would you ever consider giving a talk on critical thinking? And maybe even a series and teach us how to spot logical fallacies. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. And eventually I thought, well, I've got to actually do it somewhere along the road. I can't keep saying I'm going to do it and then not do it. So today I'm going to give you the very, very most introductory ideas and some of the informal fallacies that we commonly run into. And one of the things that I want to make sure we understand is that the whole purpose of this ultimately, although it's attenuated from the original project, but the ultimate purpose of this is to be able to help us help others see Christ. Because what we want to do is we want to break down the barriers between them and us, and sometimes those barriers are intellectual. And people can be literally imprisoned in arguments that are defective, and they don't know it. And sometimes people propagate defective arguments, and we have to be prepared to identify them and to replace them with arguments that are not defective. So part of what I'm doing today is to help A, understand what it means to be a fallacy, and B, to give you some examples of them. And then behind me there's a couple of questions. One of them is, what questions can we ask that would reveal or disarm the fallacy? I'm leaving that up there because I'm going to go through about 10 of them, 10 fallacies. And with each one, I'm going to define it, give you a couple of examples, and then I'm going to ask you the question. What questions can we ask that would reveal or disarm the fallacy? Because ultimately, it is not enough to be able to identify it. It's not enough to give it a name. We have to be able to argue or explain to them why the argument doesn't work, or ask a question that would help them see that, which works more often, by the way, than just yelling at them. So if somebody says something to you and you're immediately ready with your fallacy backpack and you pull out that particular fallacy weapon and say, well, that's a slippery slope argument, how far is that going to get you? Somebody said, well, do you ever use this with your wife? I said, well, first of all, I would never do it in the kitchen because there are knives nearby. Yeah, I wouldn't want to be a victim of that. But the answer is no, I tried it and it didn't work. And I can tell all the gentlemen in this room who are married and who might someday be married, don't do it. It's a marriage felony. So first of all, if we're going to be talking about arguments, we have to understand what an argument is and what an argument is not. So let's look at the positive side of this. An argument is a claim that's supported by other claims. Now, I know there are other definitions. If you're a mathematician, an argument means one thing. If you're a logician, an argument means something very similar to that. But for our purposes today, we're going to make it very simple, and we're going to just say that it's a claim, whatever that claim might be, supported by at least one or more other claims. That's it. So we won't talk about, I had an argument with somebody. Because I didn't have an argument. I might have had a dispute, but I didn't have an argument unless I proposed the argument. In other words, I made a claim and I supported that claim with one or more other claims. It really is that simple. So I'd like you to keep that in the back of your mind and understand that anytime we talk about arguments, this is the term we're going to be using. And then, what are fallacies? What are informal fallacies in particular? So up on the board, you see some interesting definitions. The first one is that an informal fallacy is a mistake in reasoning, or are mistakes in reasoning that don't often look like mistakes. In other words, somebody will say something, or you read something in print, or you'll see an advertisement or political propaganda, and it just sounds very convincing. It's very, very convincing. But if it's an error in reasoning and it sounds convincing, then it's by definition a fallacy. What's the difference between formal and informal? If I'm using the term informal fallacies and I keep using it over and over, because it's extremely important for you to know the difference. The difference is that in a formal fallacy, that is a structural problem. So a formal fallacy can only occur if you're using a logical structure. In other words, if I'm speccing out a logical argument and I say if P then Q, P therefore Q, that's a logical argument, okay? But that's a formal argument because the letters P and Q represent whatever we want it to represent. There's no content to them. So it's merely form. So if I do that errantly, if I don't use the laws of logic in a formal logical structure, that's a formal fallacy. Formal fallacy. Now, the second one talks about what is an informal fallacy, and it's an argument where the real-world content matters. So let's say the argument... Well, you know what? Let me actually put something up on the board here. Let's get really technical and pretend like we're in class. I even brought my own pens. Are these not sexy colors? Okay, these are great. These are great. I got all sorts of neat colors. They're made by the Crayola Company, by the way. Okay. All right, this is a formal argument. If P, then Q. P, therefore Q. So we derive Q from this conditional, fits the laws of logic. So it's probably the simplest one you're going to find. The only one simpler than that is the one called repetition, where you have the same thing up here as you have down here, perfectly legitimate, logical. All right, so this is a structural problem. If I were to say, instead of getting Q, I were to get P, that would be a fallacy. Because you cannot deduce from this P. Unless you have... I'm doing this wrong here. I say Q. I cannot derive P. So just let me tell you that that's true. This particular violation is called affirming the consequent. It's a violation of the laws of logic. You're not allowed to do that. So this is a formal fallacy. No more logic lessons for now. I do, by the way, have one derivation that I can put on the board where we're going to prove something that's absolutely crazy, and you get to see it live and in concert right here if you stay tuned. So what if we do this? What if instead of saying P and Q, let's make them other letters that makes it just a little bit easier. If Mark goes to the store, then he buys chocolate. Yummy, some people are liking that already. Mark went to the store. What can we conclude from that? He bought chocolate. Okay. Well, the truth is Mark hates chocolate. Okay, so what the real world content of this, there's a problem. Mark doesn't like chocolate, so he's not going to do it. So structurally, this is completely sound. What about this? If Mark goes to the store, he buys chocolate. Mark has chocolate. Therefore, Mark went to the store. No? Yes? Okay, you guys have caught it already. The structure allows me to say that this is a fallacy. It's a logical fallacy. It's a formal fallacy. But as a matter of fact, Mark did go to the store. Okay? So what? All right, so here's the problem. That fallacies have different compositions. They're either real world or they're formal. And so what we're going to be talking about is real world stuff, where the content, the discussion of what is it, what's contained and what's said is actually what matters. Not all informal fallacies have names. I have a book right here with a long, long list of fallacies in it. Just tons of them. I have two more books here with a whole bunch more. If you were to go on the internet, as I have done, and looked around and tallied them up, I could find up to 300. 300 logical or informal fallacies. Are there more than that? Yes. Why do you think there's more than 300 fallacies?
There's religious fallacies too.
There are religious fallacies. Yes, there are. And you're starting to get into where we're going with this. And that is that not all informal fallacies have names. Because for every defect in reasoning, there is a fallacy. And some defects of reasoning are very complicated and don't have names yet. And they operate in particular domains. So you could have something that's in movie making, you could have something in religion, you could have whatever. So why bother if there's so many of them, there's as many different fallacies as there are weird ways of thinking, why even name them? Why do you think we ought to name fallacies? Yes, at least some of them we can identify. We can point to them. And when we point to them and we can identify them, it makes them very, very quick to bring them to mind when we see them. So when I teach a critical thinking class, one of the things I tell all the students is, you're going to learn a lot of different things. But one of the things you absolutely need to make sure you master is this small catalog of fallacies that we're going to teach you. Get those down, because these you're going to see over and over and over again. And sometimes they're going to take mysterious forms. You know, you look at it and you say, well, that paragraph just sounds odd. I don't get where they're going with that. And you're just thinking to yourself, you know, that doesn't make sense. Something about that is off. But when you know the names of the arguments, you can usually peg the name of the argument and apply it to it, and then you can immediately figure it out. And what that leads you to is this. Asking a question of the person to help either reveal or disarm the fallacy. Not to call them names, just to say, well, let's think about this for a second, and then you ask them a question. And if you ask the right questions, the aha light comes on in their head, and they say, oh, I get it. That's what I did wrong. Some of them will get mad at you, but that's not your problem. Please.
Therefore, marriage is not real.
Correct. I'm glad you identified that for us. There's always one, and I love it. Thank you. Some informal fallacies are logically valid. Some informal fallacies are logically valid. And so we have to be careful when we toss around the term that's valid or invalid that we know what we're talking about when we talk about validity.
Can you give an example?
I will give you an example later. Yes, please.
What, your one about chocolate, you didn't like the chocolate, so therefore you didn't buy it?
But yeah.
Maybe your wife loves chocolate. So just because you don't like chocolate doesn't mean you won't go to the market.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And that's the messiness of fallacies, is it all involves what the real world is doing. As opposed to the formal structures of logic, I just put P then Q, P therefore Q. It doesn't matter what P and Q are. But P and Q could be some weird, really weird things. And actually, one of the things I'm going to show you is so bizarre, you will not believe it is logically valid. You're going to want to pick up stones, throw them at me, and hurl me off the cliff. Sounds familiar, yeah. I did watch the Jesus film. See, I told you. Yeah. And some formally valid arguments can be real-world nonsense. And you need to know that, too. Because you'll hear people say, well, that's not logical. Yeah, well, logic doesn't guarantee you accuracy. Logic only guarantees you that the structure is correct. It doesn't guarantee you that the premises are true. And if the premises aren't true, then they can't guarantee that the conclusion is true. But just because the premises aren't true doesn't mean the conclusion isn't true. So, is there any other way I can right now torque your mind and make you feel like you didn't want to be here? Yes, the best is yet to come. So, it's important for you to know these things. Again, I don't ask you to memorize this stuff, but I want to at least open your mind up to the understanding that fallacies are informal and formal. That there are more than we can name on the informal fallacies. That you shouldn't get too wrapped up in trying to say things are logical unless you know logic well enough to do that. But you can always argue that something isn't reasonable. Everybody can do that without training. So how do you go about it? Okay, you know what? I gotta show you this one. The last thing says, a formally valid argument can be real-world nonsense. Let me wait till Sierra Madre's only siren in the world goes by. No, I don't know. I think that I cause emergencies. Because whenever I come up, a siren goes. Therefore, what? I cause the emergency. Bad, bad logic. All right, so I'm going to give you a contradiction, and then I'm going to give you a conclusion from that contradiction. And what this is going to do is going to prove or explain the bottom part. The formally valid argument can be real-world nonsense. So in logic, you can create a proof by which any conclusion whatsoever, any contradiction whatsoever, allows you to conclude anything whatsoever. Okay, you with me? No, you're not with me. No, you're not. All right, so here's how it works. Mark is an animal. The contradiction, the other proposition is Mark is not an animal. So those are two premises. In fact, I'll even draw them up here. Mark is an animal. Mark is not an animal. Therefore, tell me any fact you want to tell me. The stock market is going up. Is that nonsense? Yeah, it's nonsense. It's ridiculous. It sounds stupid. This is a logically valid argument. So you're saying, how does that work? All right, well, tell me the square root of negative 2. Okay, it's going to be an imaginary number. Yeah, it's going to be an imaginary number. There's no real number like that. It's an imaginary. So you look at this, and it's kind of the same thing. What you need to understand in logic is that it's very much like mathematics. It will allow you to derive things that, if you actually put real-world propositions in there, they do not make sense. This one is the best one. This one, if you want to look this up and actually look at the derivation, it's only 7 steps long. It's very easy to do. And it's called the principle of explosion. Look that up in your Wikipedia or whatever you look it up. Principle of explosion. There are some logicians who don't like this, but when you use the simple predicate calculus, it always works. So, does not make a bit of sense, but there it is. Now, there are lesser extreme examples of it. So, if you plug in anything you want into some of these formulas, or in some of these logical arguments, you'll come up with wacky stuff that's not real, because you can say anything you want, you can put anything you want in here. So, somebody said, well, could give me an example of a logically valid argument that doesn't make any sense at all. This is one of them. This is the most difficult to understand. Please.
But aren't you smart stating that on the top of the line that both are true?
Yes.
Now, if they're mutually exclusive, if they're contradictory, how can they both be true?
That's a very good question. That's my point, is that this looks absurd. As a matter of fact, this is the definition of absurdity, that I'm uttering a contradiction.
And how is it logically valid?
Because the rules of logic say it is.
And the rules of logic are illogical.
No. They're unreasonable, but they're not illogical. No, this is just exactly like I gave you with the, you know, the square root of a negative number. I mean, you're gonna have a problem with some of those if you try to conceive of them in the same way that you conceive of the real world. This is designed as a system to formulate propositions so that you can always rely on the structure. A valid argument is an argument that follows the rules of logic. There's another kind of argument where it can't be nonsense, and that is an argument that's called sound. So a sound argument is an argument that is valid and the conclusion is true. Okay? So a sound argument has to have a true conclusion and be logically valid. That's a sound argument. An unsound argument can be this. Okay? Because this is false. You know, it is not true that the stock market's up, or it is not true that the moon is made of green cheese, or whatever I want to put in there. Okay, would you like me to leave this up here so you guys can just memorize this and show it to friends and influence people at your next party? Because they're going to need all the alcohol they can get to buy this. Principle of explosion, look it up. Mark Perez did not invent that. So let's look at just a handful of these informal fallacies. If you were going to guess what an unqualified expert fallacy was, what would you say? You can't be wrong. I mean, you can get close, you can get far, but I just want you guys to play with me, okay? Brosh, you can play with me. Come on, let's go.
Just describing somebody as unqualified based on whose criteria?
Good. Thank you. That's a good question. What else? What other things? Please.
I found it on the internet.
Yeah, that's probably a good example of it. Yeah. Anything else? Anybody else want to take a shot at it? Please.
Whose standards to establish qualifications for the expert?
Good. That's a good question to ask. So let's kind of look at a definition of this. Now, mind you, I'm going to give you definitions. In some of these, there are other definitions, which is one of the reasons why learning fallacies or informal fallacies in particular is not as easy as it looks. It's just not like you go down a table, you memorize them, and everybody agrees with them. For example, later on I'm going to talk about the genetic fallacy. Well, the definition I'm going to give you of the genetic fallacy is different from what some people give as the genetic fallacy. Does that mean they're wrong? No, it means they're using it differently. But it makes sense in both directions. But I'm just going to give you the one definition that's probably the one most frequently used. So for unqualified experts, you're appealing to an authority in one field for expert opinion outside of his field.
Richard Dawkins.
Very good, Richard Dawkins. Let's look, I'm going to give you a quote here. Albert Einstein says, "Peace cannot be kept by force. It can only be achieved by understanding." And the next thing said was, Einstein was a true genius. If he thought it was true, it must be true. So, was Einstein a genius? Yeah, nobody even questioned that. But was Einstein an expert in how you keep peace? No, he really wasn't. He uttered a lot of interesting things, but being a genius at mathematics or physics doesn't make you a qualified expert in how you keep peace.
Came up with the A-bomb, so he has some
logical
fallacies.
Oops, there's another fallacy.
Mark, I can see how this could be a logical fallacy, but it may not be wrong, because somebody who's unqualified in a field may still be right about whatever they're saying.
That's true. That's one of the messy things about fallacies, is he may not be wrong. But the question is, can you derive from what they say, what they did say? So merely because Einstein was a true genius doesn't mean he knows about how to enforce peace or how to create peace. Now, somebody else mentioned Richard Dawkins. How does Richard Dawkins get appealed to as an unqualified expert.
Isn't
he a scientist? Yes, he's a biologist.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Like, I always ask you, how do these biologists look at this and then believe in Darwinism or atheism? Here, they're looking at the cell. How did they don't know how it came about, but yet they're you know.
Somewhere in there, I think I get it. Yeah. It's probably between the beginning and the end somewhere. But one of the ways you could argue that Richard Dawkins is an unqualified expert in that is he's making assertions and living on his reputation as a scientist to utter things that are not within his scientific discipline. Theological questions, okay? Anybody can argue the theology that he argues without having to have a PhD. So if he wants to argue biology, well, you know, he can argue biology. He's a qualified expert in biology. So there's a lot of people that this gets appealed to. Please.
A little closer to home, I have heard arguments by scientific types, logical arguments, that Hugh Ross has no business making arguments about origin of life or about theology because his PhD is in astrophysics.
Very good point. So, are they right? No. Why are they not right? Because he studied those other disciplines and he spends the day with...
co-workers are experts in that field.
Yeah, and for him, the reason we can say he's an expert in those fields to the degree that he talks to about them. But does he ever say, I don't know that, I can't go any further than that?
Yeah.
Says it all the time. He says, I'm not the microbiologist. I'm not the biochemist. That's for somebody else. But he knows enough, and he'll say, okay, when I'm at the end of my expertise, I'm done. Whereas I've never heard Dawkins say that. Or some of the other people as well. Please, Tim.
So how do you become an expert in the field? Obviously you can get a PhD, but you're saying also Hugh Ross has studied other things. How do you go become an expert?
Good question. What makes an expert an expert? So if we want to say, well, they're an unqualified expert, what we're saying is that they don't have the background knowledge or training that another person who has that training or that particular field has. Or that they have enough training to be able to talk about what they're talking about. In other words, I have no training in nuclear physics. Now, I can talk to you a little bit about nuclear physics, but I'm going to hit the end really fast. So you wouldn't call Mark Perez an expert in nuclear physics, even though I talk about nuclear physics because I studied physics in college. But, you know, one course in physics isn't going to make me an expert in nuclear physics. So what would? 2 courses? 6 courses? 9 courses? I don't know. But enough so that if we use the legal definition, it's the general population doesn't have this expertise, and this person has more than the general population. Pretty low standard, actually. But there are other things that we can use if somebody's going to claim expertise.
30 years of studying it.
Yes,
and having his best friend be a biologist.
Yeah, 30 years of study and confronting people who know it, so that his stuff is constantly being adjusted and limited by himself and by the people he works with and the people he contests. Was that responsive to your question? Good, thank you. All right, how about another example of an unqualified expert? Can you think of somebody else? Yes, sir.
Well, this would actually be a qualified expert as a continuing comment. You could look at a guy named Langley, who was head of the Smithsonian Institution around 1900. Then there were 2 young men called the Wright brothers. And the Wright brothers had no formal education. All they did was invent the first airplane, the first wind tunnel, 14 gliders, first aircraft engine, first propeller that worked. Really quite clever fellows.
Yes.
Self-taught with no formal education. Langley had a PhD. He also made flying machines that crashed and burned. The Wrights flew. So the true experts were the people without the PhDs through years of research, experimentation, self-taught.
Well said.
You can be a self-taught expert and actually know something. Or you can be a self-taught ignoramus. It can work out either way. But
yeah.
There were 2 geniuses who just happened to have informal Another one would be Abraham Lincoln getting his own law degree through self-study.
Well said.
But then he did get a good degree. Okay, so where are you going to go with it?
Where you went? Please.
Well, Oprah's going to have a special on belief. So would that be a good example?
Yeah. If Oprah says it, it must be true. She's an expert on everything. Of course, that was a fallacy of hyperbole. Yes, please.
I don't know if it fits, but aren't we kind of unqualified experts as we try to share the gospel? We're not real theologians. I mean, some people could be this, that, and the other.
Well, we don't have to be experts because...
Study.
Yeah, but nobody's calling on us as an expert. So unqualified expert fallacy is I'm appealing to somebody as an expert in a field that they're not really an expert in. So when this person says... Einstein was a true genius. If he thought it was true, it must be true. Like anything Einstein says is true because he's a genius. So how, let's look at this question here. What questions or question can we ask of that person who says Einstein was a genius? If he thought it's true, it must be true. What will we ask of that person to reveal or disarm that fallacy? Yes, ma'am. Well, you talk about two unqualified experts being people who are being appealed to in expertise areas they don't have.
Either one of them have a PhD in meteorology.
I don't know. I don't. You're absolutely right. If anybody is appealing to them, because that's the fallacy, is the appeal to somebody else, and then holding that person up as an expert.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So let's now. I want to focus on this right now because this is really why we're here. Is what question do we ask the person who says Einstein was a true genius, if he thought it must be true? What do we ask that person to disarm that fallacy? Yes, sir.
I'm kind of backing up a little bit, but I'm hearing you use the word argument and fallacy kind of interchangeably here. Is that what your intent is, or is there a distinction?
Well, an argument isn't a fallacy, but an argument can be fallacious.
Okay.
So there are informal fallacies, but an argument is fallacious. So it's a fallacy of argument.
All right. Now, when you say up here that example of an unqualified expert argument, and a few moments ago I heard you say example of an unqualified expert fallacy, are you saying the same thing there, or are you saying try to distinguish something different?
No, I don't think I'm making a distinction. What I'm doing here is I'm showing you an argument in which they're appealing to an unqualified expert. So it's an example of the fallacy of unqualified expert.
Okay.
Is that
yeah.
Responsive? Thank you. Yes, sir. What is your basis for making that claim?
Whoever you are, expert or not, why do you believe that?
So if the person says Einstein was a true genius if he thought it, then you would ask me, well, what's your basis for believing that?
Right.
Well, I say, well, my basis, he's a genius. So keep going.
I would still say, what is your basis for making that particular claim?
Oh, well, my basis is that I think geniuses are just really smart and they'll come up with really smart stuff. Oh, I don't think so.
And then the other question is obviously what's the good. My point is, do they actually use their life to what they say? And a lot of these geniuses have these double standards where they say they believe something, but they don't live the same way. I mean,
well,
you talked about atheists being that all the way. The atheists do not live their life like what they talk. They're hypocritical, and so they really obviously don't believe what they say. And Einstein's obviously in his statement, when they're back that he is the one that invented the concept of an A-bomb, didn't really believe what he said.
Well, that's true. But then we have to be careful because that itself is a fallacious argument. And I'll explain why in a little bit. But so where we're going with what you're asking is, you're challenging me to explain why I believe that if Einstein is such a great guy, what makes him great in this?
That's right.
And that's really the essence of the question. The essence of the question is, what makes him an expert in this one particular thing? Not just because he's a genius, because geniuses don't know everything. And you ask the question properly, does he know everything? Or somebody else asked that question. Mara, I'm giving Mara credit, not you, okay? Don't try and steal it. Okay, I'm going to punch through a couple more of these. because I know you're going to find this hard to believe, we are not going to finish this. Okay, the is-ought fallacy. I'm not going to ask you what you think it is. I'm just going to tell you what it is. It's an assumption that because something is currently practiced, it should be practiced. And this happens a lot. Let me give you some examples. First one, oh, it's a fact that people naturally have premarital sex, so religious people ought to just accept it and stop being so uptight. It is, so it ought to be. Okay, that's the is-ought fallacy. It's pretty easy to spot. Second one, people now throughout history have used drugs of all kinds recreationally. We ought to just stop trying to outlaw it. Okay, that's the is-ought fallacy. Because it's continually being done, we ought to just leave it alone and let it go. Now, those arguments will occur all over the place. Sometimes it's not a bad argument, but sometimes it is a fallacy. Do you like the border on this? I just want somebody to say that's a nice border. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Okay, that was wishful thinking right there. I was wishing it to be good, even though it wasn't. All right, well, what is wishful thinking and how does it occur? This you see a lot. And it's assuming without good evidence that because one wants something to be true, it is true. Now, I'm not talking about fairy tales here. Let's look at these examples. So the first one is one we see a lot. We don't have a naturalistic answer to the origin of life yet, but we know eventually science will find it. That is a fallacy of wishful thinking. The next one. We haven't found the neuronal correlates to consciousness yet, but the history of science tells us that even the most difficult mysteries can be scientifically explained. We know consciousness is nothing more than brain activity.
That's a fallacy of wishful thinking, too.
That is a fallacy of wishful thinking. That's why it's used as an example. So you can see all of these examples will show up in science making claims about things that science can't prove. Now, the opposite of that is the God of the Gaps arguments, but that has its own fallacy, but there's sometimes where it works. Please.
One wishful thinking idea is related to country of origin. We Americans think that we're the best of everything, and we created the best and first, top of everything. And I just had a message that he was talking about the Wright brothers, who were the first Americans first to create airplanes. They were not the first to create airplanes. They were the first Americans to write to create airplanes. But the first person to ever create an airplane was a Frenchman about 30 years earlier than the Wright brothers lifted theirs off the ground. And so therefore we have this national pride that we were first, but we were the first.
Well, it's not a fallacy. It's actually just being wrong. It's just erroneous. And actually, it's part of a cognitive bias, and we'll get into cognitive biases another time. But the nationality cognitive bias, there is actually a cognitive bias for nationality or national arrogance, and we won't get into that. Well, you know, if the shoe fits, whatever. So time snobbery. This works in both directions, by the way. So old thinking versus recent thinking. It's what's new and modern is always better than what's been in the past. So here's a couple. We need to just get past all this ancient religious stuff. This is the 21st century. We're liberated from the moral prison of the ancients.
That's snobbery.
That is snobbery, yeah. Well, there's no other argument other than it's just old. Well, what makes it wrong? Because it's old. Human nature has evolved. Modern thinking creates a better world than our grandparents ever dreamed of. We have nothing to learn from our ancestors' obsolete thinking. You will hear that. You will hear all sorts of things like this. When I was going on the internet looking for examples of this stuff, I was looking for it in places where it was actually built into the fallacies, and then I was looking for it in the wild. Oh my gosh. I almost went blind looking at all the different things that there were in advertising, politics. If you get any group that has a particular bias one way or the other, I don't care whether it's Christian or atheist, you look on the Christian sites and you look on the atheist sites, what a harvest of fallacies. If you want to go fallacy harvesting, go on both sides. You could just, they're just all sorts of them. The one of them that I found really interesting, and I don't mean to beat up on our Young Earth brothers, but you know, you go to some of the Young Earth Christian sites. If somebody says, "Go ahead," I'm not going to beat anybody up. But honestly, without trying, I looked at the Young Earth stuff, and it was more loaded with fallacies than I saw on the non-Young Earth stuff. Because some of it isn't old Earth; it's just neutral. They don't even talk about the age of the Earth. And I don't know why. I just want to leave it alone and say that we have to be careful because we do it as well as everybody else does it. And, you know, Dave uttered a fallacy when he said, you know, that some of these atheists don't live according to their own ideas. Well, yeah, they don't. So what? That doesn't make them wrong. It just makes them inconsistent. It just makes them hypocrites. Okay, well, there's actually a hypocrisy fallacy. So, is it your first name, sir?
Dennis.
Dennis, I apologize. I keep forgetting your name, and that their name tag looks like an eye chart. I'm kind of trying to, and I'm not that good seeing. So Dennis says, well, you know, it's immoral to commit adultery, and he, you know, he's had seven adulterous relationships. And I just say, well, you're a hypocrite. Why would I believe you? Well, is he right? Is adultery immoral? Yeah. Well, it doesn't matter that he's done it 50 times. It just matters that it's immoral.
Makes him an expert.
Makes him an expert. So, when we start talking about adultery, we need to appeal to a qualified expert. Dennis, thank you for being such a good punching bag. I appreciate that. All right, it's 12:30 now, and I have to turn this off. So, we will pick up. I'll get some more of these. I have a list of them, and we'll go through them. But what I really want to end this with is this: that as we understand the fallacies, we're able to identify them. That we look everywhere for them, and the first place to look is in the mirror.
That's right.
Because we're all vulnerable to them, and the bigger the argument, the more propositions that are in an argument, the more likely you are to suffer one. Because we don't sit around and start writing up formulas like a logician would and then transpose that into natural language. We don't do it that way. Some people do. We call them freaks. Or nerds, yes. But the rest of us, ordinary humans, don't do that. So as we learn more about this, just realize the purpose of this is to help us help other people to get out of the trap of fallacious reasoning and for us to make sure we avoid it. I don't even have time for questions. But we will have next month, and I'll come back next month with my suitcase full of fallacies. All right, so let me close us in prayer, and then we will finish up. Lord, thank you so much for our time that we even can be here. I pray especially, Lord, that as we think about fallacies and reasoning and arguments, that we won't become rigid and locked into just being logic-chopping people, but people who are wise and use this for discernment above all else. And I also pray that the people in this class who are interested in evangelism will come up and look at the things that we have for the Jesus film, because so many of us are timid about our faith and shouldn't be. May this help us to get rid of the timidity. And we'll bless you, Lord, and we pray that we would glorify your name in everything we do. Amen.